from WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Good versus Evil. It's the stuff of politics and movies, what movies are made of. Right now on the world stage, it's the world versus Saddam on movie screens. It's Harry Potter versus Voldemort. So long, sci-fi. Hello, sorcerers. In this hour, On Point, 21st century Hollywood plunges back to wizardry in the Middle Ages. We ask why. We begin with today's announcement that President Bush has tapped former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to lead an independent commission to investigate national security failures and the 9/11 terrorist attack. The creation of the panel is part of a broad intelligence authorization bill signed today by the president. Kissinger's commission will be made up of five Republicans and five Democrats. Robert Schulzinger is director of the International Affairs Program at the University of Colorado and longtime Kissinger watcher. I asked him what he thinks the choice of Henry Kissinger might signal about what the president wants from the new panel.
Kissinger is a very prominent man. He's played a role in every Republican administration since that of Gerald Ford. He has an enormous reputation at home and overseas. Of course, in recent years, there's been very serious criticism of Henry Kissinger, so it may very well be a controversial nomination. But on balance, he is so prominent, I think that's why President Bush chose him.
So prominence is number one. It's a bona fide big name. No one can argue with that. Would President Bush have special comfort that Kissinger would not rock the boat too much, or can he be sure of that?
Well, he's certainly talked with Kissinger, told him what the brief is, what he's supposed to do in this. I don't know if rock the boat is the proper way of putting it. Kissinger headed another commission 20 years ago for Ronald Reagan on Central America. That was a bipartisan commission, and the end result was actually to lower the temperature of the debate over U.S. Central America policy. I'm sure that's what President Bush would like this commission to do.
A kind of mollifying effect rather than throwing grenade into the government structure?
I think that's a good way of putting it. But I think that the president also believes that Kissinger is so prominent that the conclusions that his commission will come up with will satisfy a broad consensus. I don't know if that's true. Obviously, we have to wait and see what the commission does.
You've followed Henry Kissinger for many years. Put us as far into his shoes as you can. How do you think he'll approach this task? What kind of instincts will he bring to the charge of investigating 9/11?
Kissinger has been very concerned ever since he began this kind of work in the 1950s about generating a consensus on foreign policy. So in that regard, I think he will reach out. He won't reach out totally across the political spectrum, but he tries to find the center of where people think of American foreign policy and articulate it. He's very good at articulating that point of view. Also, Kissinger has been very aware throughout the last 45 years of when things need to change, when things are not going in the right direction. He did that with Vietnam. He did that with relations with the Soviet Union, with detente. And this commission comes about at a time of intense scrutiny and unhappiness about the way 9/11 came about. And I think he would want to come up with an investigation that tries to satisfy this sense of unhappiness.
After Pearl Harbor, with which 9/11 has often been compared, or at least was in the early days after those attacks, after Pearl Harbor, there was very quickly an investigation and heads rolled. This time, President Bush resisted an independent commission, and heads have not rolled. Can you imagine Henry Kissinger coming into the fray and saying, we have to have some responsibility taken here, or is it already too late for that?
I don't know that it's too late for that, although the commission isn't going to bring it in its report for another 18 months. It's not inconceivable or even unlikely that before that happens, people will have left the office. And by the time it comes in with its report, I think things will have moved on beyond looking for particular people in responsibility. So I don't think that will be the main focus of the commission.
Kissinger is a battle-tested war horse. He's also, in the eyes of his tough critics, been called a war criminal.
Does naming him to this post limit the scope of the investigation? Is Henry Kissinger so much of the middle or of the towers of power that he's not going to shake things up too much? Or might he come to this as a kind of last hurrah and say, I'm going to tell it like it is, here's the bitter medicine?
Well, he's going to tell it like it is the way he thinks it is. But he's certainly not someone to, use your phrase, throw hand grenades. What's going to be interesting over the next few days is the level of the criticism directed at this choice. Kissinger has come under the most intense scrutiny and criticism of his career in the last 18 months.
For activities in Vietnam, activities in Chile.
That's absolutely correct. How strong that's going to be in the next days and weeks, we don't know. Most of that criticism has come from, I guess you would call it, the left of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Given the current political situation in which the Republicans have won a very significant electoral victory a few weeks ago, is that criticism going to be significant? We don't know. It's altogether possible that this is an appointment of a prominent individual the administration thinks is going to calm criticism, and it's going to ignite more. We had an example of that also just in the last month with the appointment of Judge Webster to head the accounting board. He was a man of very high prominence, impeccable credentials, and he lasted a very short time.
We have to imagine that the Bush team has given this some serious thought. They must have concluded that the advantages of the big Kissinger name outweighed the potential downside. How big a gamble do you think that is?
Oh, I think it is a gamble. I think the fact they announced it the day before Thanksgiving, when people aren't going to spend a lot of attention to such news stories, shows that they have concern about that. But I think they expect that a big name like Kissinger will work the same way it did 19 years ago with President Reagan's appointment of him as head of the Commission on Latin America. We'll have to see.
Robert Schlesinger, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Robert Schlesinger is director of the International Affairs Program at the University of Colorado. He spoke with me earlier from Boulder, Colorado. We are talking this hour about fantasy in popular culture and movies. In its first week alone, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets cleared $88 million. Next month, The Twin Towers, the new installment of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, opens. Expectations are blockbuster.
Sauron's forces have begun their attack. He is using Saruman to destroy your people.
They were unarmed. They had no warning.
This is but a taste of the terror that Saruman will unleash. You must fight.
I will not risk open war.
Open war is upon you, whether you would risk it or not.
A new power is rising. Its victory is at hand.
It is an army bred for a single purpose, to destroy the world of men.
And there it is, swords not lasers, magic not molecules, villages not cities. A fantasy past is suddenly capturing America's imagination and movie dollars. This from a society that fell head over heels in love with science, technology, and sci-fi. So what gives? What's behind this 21st century allure of the rings? The current issue of Time magazine explores this pop culture phenomenon and says we are seeing what might be called the enchanting of America. Why? Why wizards and wombats and helmets with horns? Why the misty past and not the sci-fi future anymore? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Lev Grossman. He's Time Magazine's book critic and wrote the story Feeding on Fantasy for the current issue. Good evening and welcome, Lev Grossman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point movie maven Garen Daly. Garen, great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Lev Grossman, take us into the thesis here. You write that popular culture is the most sensitive barometer we have for gauging shifts in the national mood. So what's it registering now, and what do you make of it?
Well, I find it just so fascinating that, at this moment, people are choosing to become involved in these fantasy stories. And I myself enjoy them a great deal. And to me, above all, that investment in fantasy signals that our long, centuries-long sort of love affair in the West with technology is drawing to a close. the dominance of science fiction in American popular culture for the past 25 years at least seems to me to be part of our this core belief that the future is interesting, the future will be better, technology will improve our lives. And we think of these those beliefs are almost to us self-evident. We can't imagine thinking any other way. What I think is happening now is there's a little bit of disenchantment going on. Our long sort of crush on technology is giving way to a more skeptical point of view. And as a result, we're turning to fantasies about the past and swords and knights and ladies and becoming a little more involved with a nostalgic sort of sentimental idea of how things used to be.
So, Lev Grossman, let's take for the moment, let's accept your thesis. That we're kind of going
by all means, let's accept it.
For the moment, anyway, we're going south on technology, and we see how that pulls the plug on sci-fi. But why this kind of misty medieval setting in its stead? I mean, Harry Potter is not medieval, but it's got castles and wizardry and long cloaks and a lot of the trappings of that period. Why all the way back to sweaty furs and horned helmets and all that jazz? Why not something else? Why not contemporary life?
Well, aside from I think part of it has to do with the economic recession that we've been going through. I mean, escapism and a desire to get out of ourselves and to get into another reality is sort of a natural response to any economic downturn. But I really feel that the investment in fantasy, which is based on a kind of idealized version of European history, I feel like it's a response to America's sort of growing skepticism about technology and a desire to return to a time when things were handmade, when society was not globalized, but rather ensconced in cozy little villages. I really think that's what's behind the fact that fantasy is currently our escape of choice.
Kieran Daly, what's the evidence here? I know you're of at least two minds about the thesis, but do you see? You see the point that Lev Grossman's making.
Oh, yeah, I do see the point. And I think one of the things that I really enjoy about Lord of the Rings is in those little villages, you're able to go to another land. And that sense of exploration, that sense of adventure is very much evident there. And I think that's something that we miss now in our very global world, is that we don't have that ability to have an adventure where you pack up your grip, your little knapsack, and walk out and you meet a wizard and you meet a golem or you meet an orc. You meet something new and different. That part of it I enjoy. And I do think also that there is a little bit of us looking for that nice clarity of good versus evil, that we seem to be in a world of terrorists, people blowing themselves up for reasons that you don't quite understand. So having something black and white and very moral is something that I think the audience enjoys.
But Lev Grossman, black and white, very moral, good versus evil, has been often set in sci-fi settings. Are you really making the case that that's off the table now, that that's so 1990s or that's so 20th century?
Well, I certainly think the moral issue is a part of it. I think in fantasy, the question of good versus evil is always more fundamental than in science fiction, which often presents situations of enormous complexity and ambiguity. In fantasy, it's always rooted in a conflict between good and evil, and good and evil are more than just sort of positions people take. They're these fundamental forces that move the universe. If you're evil, you get all twisted and dark looking, and if you're good, you're very tall and your ears are pointy and you become rather attractive. Things really couldn't be clearer at a time when we are ourselves trying to draw clear lines between who's on our side and who is the enemy, and we're having a little bit of trouble doing it.
We're going to dig into this. We're going to test the thesis. We're talking tonight about science fiction giving way to medieval fantasy, American popular culture trading the future for the past. What does it say about our society when pop culture wants to look back in time, way back, and not forward? And do you buy the thesis? Are we romancing the sword again? Do we all want horned helmets and a wizard's wand? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about sci-fi giving way to medieval fantasy, about American pop culture trading future for past. Do you buy the thesis? Are we romancing the sword again? Do we all want horned helmets and a wizard's wand? Does the past look better than the future, or worse, and more attuned to our 21st century monsters? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Lev Grossman. He's book editor at Time Magazine, and he wrote the big piece in Time this week, Feeding on Fantasy, in the current issue. He's author of the forthcoming book, Codex, which sounds to me, Lev Grossman, more like sci-fi than medieval history, but we'll get to that. And I'm joined by Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and our On Point movie maven. Lev Grossman, what's the evidence that you mount for supporting the notion that we're turning to this misty past? Where do you see it in pop culture? We've got Lord of the Rings, we've got Harry Potter. Is that it? Is that all we need to assert the thesis?
Well, there are plenty of other data points if you want to sort of run down them. Aside from those two movies, of course, those are also books which are selling insanely well, and not just those two, but other fantasy authors like Robert Jordan and George R. R. Martin. But beyond that, you have video games like EverQuest and Ultima Online and Asheron's Call, card games like Magic the Gathering. There are any number of these massive fantasy franchises that occupy really all sectors of popular culture.
And I wonder if you see this, you described it earlier, as sci-fi and the kind of a joy of technology and the wonderment with it being left in the 20th century. But I wonder if this is not linear, but cyclical. I mean, Ivanhoe was big, 100 years ago, and Camelot was big in the 60s. And now here we are, the first decade of the 21st century, and we've got medieval themes again. Are you so sure that we're leaving this stuff behind, or is this like fashion in clothing, where wide lapels and bell bottoms come back every so often?
Well, there are certainly cycles, and of course, the last time I think we got involved in a war as dicey as the one we seem to be heading into now was with Vietnam, and that was the time when the first big Tolkien boom in America took place. I think there's an interesting correlation there. But, there are cycles, and then there are cycles. I think, we should keep in mind that the idea that technology will make our lives better and the future will be better than the present is a relatively new idea sort of in human history. I mean, we're quite odd here in America right now in that that's a sort of prevailing myth. But it's a new one, and it wasn't the case, as recently as the 18th century. So I think we should keep in mind the idea that what we think of as fixed stars like that can move and change.
Garen Daly, what do you make of the data points? Are you persuaded that we are changing horses here, that we're climbing off of sci-fi, and of course there's always exceptions, but that we're fundamentally moving into a greater infatuation with this kind of romanticized past, even when it's beastly?
I think it's a little more complex than that. First of all, when I think of the EverQuest situation, I see that
this is the online game that's set in one of these kind of knights and ladies and goblins settings.
Right. I see that more as a sense of community and a sense of getting away from your everyday life and escaping into that kind of new world where you create your own personality, your own.
But it could be any kind of setting. It could be a 25th century spaceship, and it's not set there.
That's true. But then I'd go and look at the movies. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The movies that we're seeing are the same arc. We're looking at a hero going through the same steps of denial and then a journey and then rejection and then ultimate triumph. This is the same arc that Han Solo went through. This is the same arc that occurred in the Westerns, which were very popular in the 30s. Again, looking back to the past for that kind of clarity. So I don't see the films being all that different. And I think if you asked a sci-fi person, which I am, you would say Lord of the Rings is just an extension of the sci-fi world. Now, the other thing that I think is important to notice is that the sci-fi films are all of a sudden no longer black and white. They're going into new areas. They're going into
meaning in terms of moral themes.
In terms of moral themes, right. If you take a look at Star Wars, the first Star Wars episode, which is now the fourth Star Wars episode, is a very black and white thing. But it's gotten bloated. It's gotten overblown. But you take a look at Minority Report.
This is with Tom Cruise, very sci-fi.
Spielberg. It's about a very weird kind of world. It's the Philip K. Dick world where things aren't what they seem and the government is being oppressive and undermining individuality. Mm-hmm. Those are the new themes that we're seeing in sci-fi. It's more of the individual. Spider-Man, the individual, biggest film of the year so far. You take a look. You got the Hulk coming up. You've got Matrix coming up.
So you're saying in the sci-fi realm, it's been pulled down to the individual. In these kind of quasi-historical films, there's still a sense of community.
That's what I say, yes.
Liv Grossman, Garen Daly, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Carolyn Marvin. She joins us from Philadelphia. She's professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications. Good evening. Welcome, Carolyn Marvin.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Carolyn Marvin, a couple of things. First, do you see this drift, this shift from sci-fi to this misty past? And if, as Garen Daly, our movie guy, says, the story structures are very similar, does it matter? What does it say about our popular culture, about where our minds and our imaginations are, if the stories are set in a Western setting or a spaceship or a medieval setting?
Well, I think that's really the most interesting question that you've asked as I've been listening, which is what accounts for the fact that there's this strong medieval component?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we remember that although we're now officially a multicultural society, and we think about that a lot, that's still really a political project under construction in a lot of ways. And our most comfortable resting place is an earlier kind of fairy tale culture that we're accustomed to. And this fairy tale culture, this medieval culture, if you think about it, is a Christian culture in its basis. It's a European Christian culture. And fairy tales are the sort of underside, the pagan magical part of an official Christian culture. And we're sitting here now in a very difficult world where we're facing an enemy that we've defined to ourselves as Islamic in part. I don't mean by that the whole Islamic world, but the terrorists that we're thinking about have this kind of Islamic identity. So the fact that this Christian iconography, the castles, and that this is the landscape that we're imagining ourselves in, suggests to me that has something to do with the real political situation that we're facing, that we're nervous about.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to understand how we feel about it.
Now that's interesting because you're not focusing on the kind of walking away from technology that Lev Grossman sees at the heart of this, but rather a cultural circling of the wagons going back even to the time of the Crusades.
Well, exactly. And if you'll remember, that was the word that George Bush used and then had to apologize for using. And so I think that's really floating around there underneath in the sort of cultural sources that we have available to us. In this fantasy stuff, I guess my feeling about the technology is that it's still there and that the magical things that happen in a fantasy world are technology stripped down to their moral components.
Hmm.
What we want with technology is to be able to do good in the world and to make ourselves more comfortable, and we fear that it will hurt us in some fashion. So technology is not really missing from these fantasy stories. It's just stripped down to its essence, its moral essence, I think.
Well, I wonder about that. Liv Grossman, first, on the point that Carolyn Marvin raises about these as an escape from modern dynamics, quite apart from technology, of cultural clash, of diversity. You do note that a lot of these films that we're talking about here are pretty white-skinned. They're pretty male.
I didn't have time to get into it in the article, but I actually think the racial issue is enormously important to the popularity of fantasy, especially to the popularity of fantasy among white males. In this country, in the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of emphasis on multiculturalism and ethnicity, something that white men have been largely left out of. White men have been made to feel guilty about their past, their history. They feel like they have no heritage, no ethnic group to belong to.
But guys in armor with long blonde tresses, that's a rallying point, you're saying.
That's exactly it. They're trying to give themselves an ethnic identity. They're retelling their history, which is the history of medieval Europe, in a way that feels positive and good and not tainted by colonialism and all the other historical crimes that are being piled on white men. And I think it's so important to think of that as part of the appeal of fantasy.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Emily's calling from Baraboo, Wisconsin. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to say that, well, in my school, it seems like when you ask people what movies they've seen lately, mm-hmm. it's more Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings than, say, Star Wars.
What level of school are you in, Emily?
I'm in high school.
Okay.
And
so you're confirming that. Is it because that's what Hollywood's offering, do you think, Emily, or because they're kind of fed up with spaceships and sci-fi?
I think it's because now that we're getting so much more technologically advanced, it's not quite as much of an escape from reality to watch sci-fi because it's like it's becoming our reality.
Mm-hmm.
And when we watch fantasy, medieval fantasy, it's something that we're not quite as familiar with, and it's got more of a mystery to it.
So in a funny way, it takes us further away from our lives than technology-based stories.
Yes.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. Carolyn Marvin, what about it? We noted at the top of the hour that 2001 A Space Odyssey is now literally and figuratively behind us, that the very date is behind us. Is technology so familiar that it can't rev up the engines of our imaginations anymore?
No, I think technology is still our transforming power. That's what we want from it. And but technology is has a kind of mythic structure just like morality does in a certain way. It's we have to cast it in magical terms. But I think all that magic in the fantasy has reference to technology, which we've always hoped will magically make the world be okay.
Emily, thanks for your call. Lev Grossman, I wonder about this point. Carolyn Marvin makes it again, that the magic we see here in all these films is technology stripped to its essence. Do you buy that? Is this magic as an expression, a kind of transmutation of technology, or is this something different? Is this intuition versus reason?
Well, to me, it feels fundamentally different, as you say. I agree very much that technology has acquired a sort of mundanity that it didn't always have. If you can think of the fascination of a movie like War Games, when we would look at a personal computer on Matthew Broderick's desk and say, "Ooh, look at that! I've never seen one of those before." Now we see a computer and we think of what technology can do. We think, "Oh man, it's homework." We think of our jobs, of the email that we're probably missing that we should be responding to. It's become this dreary burden rather than a mechanism of escape. Whereas I think magic is a way of thinking of a way to transform the world and affect it that is intuitive, that is connected to nature and things natural, that is without obvious explanation and hence still mysterious and fascinating.
David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening, everyone.
Hi.
Being a representative of the great unwashed middle out here, I'd like to de-intellectualize all this and give you my perspective. Hollywood, every once in a while, unfortunately it's too far and few between, gets around to making actually really good films that people enjoy seeing, i.e. Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, and being both a fantasy and sci-fi movie fan, I'm looking forward to the next Matrix. But the point is, I don't think we need to over-intellectualize this. Those films had a great cast. The storyline was, as Ms. Marvin mentioned, they're pretty stripped down and simple,
mm-hmm.
and they wrap themselves up in great cinematography. In the case of The Matrix, it was amazing cinematography with some of the special effects that went into that film. I mean, for the most part.
So you don't think the setting matters much? If it's a good movie, if it tells a good story, if it's got good costumes and effects, you don't want to make too much of where it's set, even if this medieval kind of setting starts popping up all over the place, David?
Yeah, I'm not too wrapped up in it. I mean, my kids enjoyed Harry Potter. They just loved it. They loved Lord of the Rings. I have an older son that I allow to watch Matrix. The younger ones, it's not a film for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we don't put on our wizard hats and sit down and watch Harry Potter. We don't have to get into the whole theme. We just enjoy, as a family, tossing the DVD in it and kicking back and watching a good movie and eating popcorn.
We got it, David. Thanks for your call, Garen Daly. There it is. It's just a good movie. Do you see good movies coming from both of these streams even now? Do you see a kind of shift in the output that's out there already or that's expected from Hollywood?
Well, Hollywood is always looking to find something that is going to grab people's imagination, and they are looking for something that's fresh. And I think there's two points to be made about both Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings. The first one is that I think it's interesting that we're talking about how both of these films strip away technology, but it is technology of making the movies that allows these to happen, because the ability to make special effects on screen believable
has, on that scale
has blossomed in the last 5 years. The other thing is that we have to look at what is the actual, who is actually seeing these films. And in both of these films, two out of three people watching these films are not in the United States. They're international people.
Does sci-fi travel better, or does medieval fantasy stuff travel better?
Actually, I think it's the medieval fantasy stuff, because it's a little more black and white. But both of these films were designed to be international hits rather than U.S. hits. And that's an important part of what's going on in Hollywood right now. The industry needs to have films that are bringing in lots of money from across the world.
And that's working. Carolyn Marvin, you heard our caller say it doesn't really matter what the setting is as long as it's a good movie, as long as it's a good story. Do you buy that? Is the setting irrelevant? If the setting of our imagination, the kind of seedbed, moves, should we read something into that or not?
Well, let me say first that the thing that travels best internationally in movies is violence. I think that's a very well-established fact. But, you know, this is always a really interesting question, is what can you learn from the popular culture by looking at it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's lots and lots of competing messages out there in the popular culture. There's a lot of things that Hollywood's trying to do at once. Only some of them become popular. Mm-hmm. And so I think what is interesting is, what are the things that grab our imagination? Because in the end, Hollywood can only sell us what we've got the ears to listen to. We're not listening to everything all the time. Some things raise issues for us that are far more compelling, and those are the things that become important. And the other thing here, too, is that Hollywood isn't an alien culture. It consists of people who are in the culture, in fact, and thinking about these same kinds of things. And, in fact, they have some of the most sensitive antenna around. It's their job, in some way, to have their ears up for what it is that's moving people at any one moment. And we have at least two cultures in that sense. We have an official political culture that binds us all together, where we have to decide what are we going to do and have rational, critical reasons for doing it that we have to defend and so forth. And this is the culture that is common to us all that we can talk about on that level. But the popular culture is a place where we can imagine what we feel, think about what makes us nervous, think about what makes us scared, what makes us reassured. That's not really worked out a lot in the political culture. And in the popular culture is where that's the big stew of all our emotional postures, and where we sort of bump up against each other and say, you know, how are we feeling about this right now?
That's what we're turning our eye tonight. We've got to take a short break. Carolyn Marvin, stay with us. Lev Grossman, Garen Daly, we're talking about science fiction giving way to medieval fantasy, about American popular culture trading future for past. Are you under the spell of potions, damsels, guys with swords? Are we wishing we could wave a wand and change the world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about sci-fi giving way to medieval fantasy. My guests are Lev Grossman with Time Magazine, Carolyn Marvin with the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications, and our own movie maven, Garen Daly, here in the studio with me. Question for you, what's happened to the allure of the future, of space? Is it just cold and empty out there? And is the past, with all its blood and gore and mysticism, more alluring than biotech and smart bombs? Does the rise of Dumbledore and Frodo mean anything more than a retro fashion trend, the return of bell-bottoms? And are you trying to get in touch with your inner medieval brute? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. On the line from Minneapolis right now, I have Darren Chermak. He's a sword-carrying member of the Society for Creative Anachronism. Darren, what is that? Why are you a member?
Well, I'm a member, Tom, because I was interested at a young age in the medieval times and what you could wind up learning and doing in that time, and
This is the gang that dresses up in armor and woolly suits and swords and runs around the woods.
Woods, plains, what have you. We do recreate battles, feasts, all the things that would draw you in your first imagination of what medieval life would have been like.
My notes say that by day you're an inventor, and by weekend you are Tristan von Eisen, nobleman of the barony of Nordskogen. What gets fired up in your imagination when you put on the costume and do your thing there, Darren?
The same thing that got me fired up, I think, as a boy, imagining what it would be like to be a knight on a field of combat, what it would be like to live in an age of chivalry and courtesy, the ideals that were in an age before ours.
Is it running away from reality today? Is it running away from the future?
I don't really picture it as running away. I picture it as having a reverence for our past and some of the ideals that our forefathers tried to strive for, but sometimes we fall a little short of.
Darren, have a good turkey drumstick tomorrow.
I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Carolyn Marvin, how do you interpret if we're going to interpret these things, what does this new kind of interest tell us about our cultural, our social health? Does it say we're more at grips or less at grips with issues right in front of us?
Well, I don't think that fantasy, I mean, the particular themes of fantasy may be specific to this period, but fantasy is something that human beings just do. I mean, they like to go places where they haven't been in order to figure out creative new responses to the situations they're in, to consider what it is they're looking at. I mean, this is not any sign of ill health. It's the healthiest thing we can do.
But a movie like Minority Report looks at potential fictional sci-fi destruction of privacy that could be in our relatively near future, whereas these other things are set in, you know, far distant mystical pasts. Does it matter in terms of how we're at grips with life?
Well, now, let me see if I understand your question, Tom. You think that because we put the fantasy in a different time period that this says something about our ability to cope with the present?
I really don't know, but I can see that one is tied to issues as real as the Patriot Act and John Ashcroft's current steps in the United States of America in 2002. The other, if it's at grips with the issues we face today, it's in a much more transmuted way.
Well, I think that we're symbolic creatures and we can be just as flexible we want with the present and the past. I mean, we've certainly got plenty of television shows right now, for example, that treat the government as very benign indeed. I mean, you know, there's The West Wing, there's the various shows about judges and Supreme Courts and social works and so on. So we're perfectly capable of imagining, of having fantasies, if you will, about a benign government as well as a very evil one.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another call. Ken's calling. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Happy Thanksgiving Eve, folks.
Same to you.
I think you have it backwards. Technology and the creation of science itself has always chased the metaphysical. Even the creation of the city and the nation state was essentially an imitation of the powers of godhood, the ability to be immortal and to wield resources far beyond the individual.
So the kind of images and language that we associate with medieval mysticism, you're saying, are in fact driving forces even in technology.
And driving forces of civilization, period. And the history of the Lord of the Rings and even Harry Potter, you know, you should inform the people that with the production schedules of these films, long before we got in this situation, those films were in production.
Long before 9/11, certainly.
Right. And in turn, the books themselves, there's a confluence here which is tremendous. It's an example of Jung's synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
Because both in the 60s, and now, Tolkien's works came to the fore in the 60s because he had finally ended the legal battle with Ace for the original editions, which were printed in the 50s, and he was a philologist. So he was very upset by Ace's anglicizing of languages and terms that he had essentially created.
But are you drawing a larger parallel between the 60s when this became popular in the States and now, this decade?
Well, I think synchronicity is what reigns. I think that in both cases, these works, which in other words, I really don't think of these films as the Lord of the Rings. They're excellent. They're probably as close as we'll get for another 30 years. 30 years ago, we had Bakshi's version, a dedicated filmmaker just like the present gentleman who brought the cartoons to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have this dedicated filmmaker bringing his version, but it's not Lord of the Rings, because the texture and not simpleness of black and white, but the texture, for instance, in Tom Bombadil being absent from the first film, that showed a power which they could have run to and given the ring to.
Off it goes, the ring and Tom Bombadil. Ken, thank you for your call. Lev Grossman, what about it? Ultimately here, you raised the question in your piece of whether this is running away from reality or just addressing it from another angle.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, in most works of art, there's a bit of both going on. But I think it's really important not to be condescending to these movies and think of them, you know, just as people putting their heads in the sands. You know, we identify, you know, the stuff of fantasy, knights and lords and ladies. We identify it, I think, sometimes with fairy tales. But just because it uses that symbolic language doesn't mean it can't address very complex psychological issues. I mean, I think Frodo's struggle with temptation throughout the rings, just to give one example, is this very you know, intense, very real, very painful, you know, psychological story that gets told. It's certainly not unsophisticated, and it's not a case of people just running off into happy lands. Bad things happen in those movies, and watching them is a way of dealing with bad things that happen in our own lives.
Lev Grossman, you've opened a window for us, and we appreciate it. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Lev Grossman is book editor at Time Magazine. And Carolyn Marvin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Carolyn Marvin joined us from Philadelphia. She's professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications. Garen Daly, last word goes to you. Are we going to see more of this, or is this a flash in the pan of guys in armor and damsels by the lake?
Well, we're definitely going to see some more medieval kind of films, some more fantasy kind of films, and I think they're going to be excellent quality, but we're also going to see science fiction films, because sci-fi has been around since the beginning, and it has always reflected parts of our culture, and continue to do so.
We stay tuned. Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, thanks for joining us
hour.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, talking turkey with the Butterball Hotline. This is On Point. You've seen it happen. It's not pretty. Thanksgiving Day, just about noontime, the chef's in tears. Something is terribly, horribly wrong. Hosting Thanksgiving dinner can be more than a little intimidating. A lot can go wrong. The turkey doesn't defrost. Smoke pours out of the oven. The family's divided. Cook the stuffing in the bird or alongside. For more than two decades, desperate home chefs have turned to the experts at the Butterball Turkey Talk line to save Thanksgiving. Dorothy Jones has staffed the hotline for the past 18 years. In her tenure, she's talked with thousands of frantic cooks through every kind of crisis, from undercooked turkey to accidental turkey flambé. In this radio diary, she says for some cooks, turkey panic sets in even before they get the bird home.
We get people who start calling us from the aisles of the store when they're trying to decide how much turkey they need to buy. Then we do get a lot of people making plans ahead of time, calling us the day ahead of time, getting times and temperature, and also they're reading the instruction folder that does come with a Butterball turkey, but they said that they still needed to double check on some things and give us a call. Some simply can't believe that we are saying that you don't need to rinse the turkey. All you really need to do is pat it dry with disposable paper towels. We had a woman who was meticulously cleaning the cavity of the turkey with a toothbrush for a couple of hours. There was a woman who was cleaning her turkey by using a metal scouring pad. At first, we didn't know what she meant when she called and said, how do I get these little metal pieces out of the skin? Found out that she was using a metal scouring pad to try to clean the turkey. There was a man who called, and he said his stove was broken, and he wanted to know if there was enough steam in his dishwasher that he could steam cook his turkey. There was a restaurant owner from Pennsylvania who called, and he had only a pizza oven in his restaurant that he could use to roast the turkey, but his pizza oven, you know, is at a high oven temperature, like about 525 degrees, and had to give him the bad news that he was not going to be able to get a good result by putting a turkey. It would kind of incinerate at 525 degrees in a pizza oven. You know, we do a lot of couples counseling here, and we had the man who called. He had heard about a terrific idea of pouring bourbon over the turkey, which he did. He poured bourbon over his turkey. He did have a higher oven temperature set, like 425 degrees, so he was quickly flambéing the turkey, which he didn't really want to do. It was burning over the skin, and his wife was in the bedroom crying, so he was calling us to see if he could salvage the turkey. The turkey hadn't been in the oven very long, so he really needed to remove the skin of the turkey, which is protection, helps to keep it from drying out. But he could use a steaming method of cooking by wrapping the turkey in heavy-duty foil, and he could at least get the turkey cooked up to a hot, safe temperature. And, of course, it's not going to be hardly close to being picture-perfect, but they could still have their traditional Thanksgiving meal with turkey. It's difficult to convince people that turkeys are going to cook in a short amount of time compared to years ago. All the turkeys nowadays are young turkeys. They do cook quickly compared to 35 years ago, and we do have women who are calling and admitting their age. I'm 96, I'm 88, I haven't made a turkey for 30 or 35 years. Help me refresh what I need to do with the turkey. And they're going by old charts in old cookbooks. We have young cooks on Thanksgiving Day who you can tell by their voices they've never made a turkey, because when they're going into the turkey and they're finding the bag of giblets, and they say, oh, yuck, what are these things? Do I need to touch them? What can I do with them? So we give those young men and women permission to throw the bag of giblets away. A lot of people forget to look and find that bag of giblets. So there they are roasting the turkey. It comes out of the oven and they see this plastic bag sticking out. Well, you're not sacrificing your turkey. You certainly can't use those giblets. They will be pretty tough, but those people who forgot to look for them, they're not the ones who think of the giblets as jewels. So they're really not losing much by having tough giblets. People see commercials that talk about a tender, juicy turkey, and they certainly don't want to have anything less than a tender, juicy turkey. It is our national celebration of family, friends, and food. So there is some stress there, and it's also because a lot of people only make a whole turkey once a year. Everybody is familiar with doing smaller turkey parts during the year or turkey breast, but when it comes to a whole turkey, it is a bit intimidating when you're doing it only once a year. So it's really makes you feel good to get all those wonderful thank yous on Thanksgiving Day from the people that you've helped.
Dorothy Jones has staffed the Butterball Turkey Talk Hotline for 18 years. There's an American hero for you. This year, for the first time, the hotline will stay open through the Christmas season. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our